Hey guys, this is episode number 6 of Forensic Tales. As always, I'm your host, Courtney. And this week, I'm going to talk about the murder of Crystal Beslanowicz, a 17-year-old girl from the state of Utah. Her killer almost got away with the perfect murder for nearly 18 years. How did police finally catch their suspect and bring him to justice after all these years? Well, you guys, it involved my least favorite household item, a vacuum. On December 14th, 1995, around 8 p.m. near Salt Lake City, Utah, 17-year-old Tracy Beslanowicz tells her boyfriend Chris that she's hungry and that she's going to run to a local Circle K to get some food. A few hours go by, and Tracy still hasn't returned back to the motel in which her and her boyfriend Chris are currently living in. So at 11 p.m. that night, Chris starts to worry about Tracy, and he decides that he can't just sit in the motel and do nothing. So he decides to make his way to the local Circle K to see if Tracy might still be there, or maybe just talk to someone who might have seen her earlier that night. Chris, however, learns nothing about where his girlfriend is. Tracy has never been gone the whole night, let alone a few hours. Her and Chris were super close and basically spent every waking moment by each other's side. When Tracy wasn't at the motel, Chris knew exactly where she was. So it was super unlike Tracy to just be gone and not heard from. The entire night passes, and there was absolutely no sign of Tracy anywhere. Instead of calling the police that night, Chris starts knocking on several neighbors' doors throughout the motel. But after each knock, he gets the same thing. No one has seen or even heard from Tracy all night long. At this point, Chris is starting to feel really worried about his girlfriend Tracy. The following morning at 8:40 a.m. on December 15th, 1995, nearly 45 miles away from Tracy and Chris's motel room, a rancher and his son spot something in the distance that catches their eye. As the rancher gets closer, he tells his son that he thinks there might be a mannequin down by the river. A few minutes later, however, the rancher and his son quickly realize that this is no mannequin. The rancher and his son immediately call the local sheriff's department to report that there is a dead body down by the Provo River. The officer who first arrives on scene that morning thinks that he's just responding to a simple call. He thinks maybe it's just a fisherman who simply passed away along the river. But as he makes his way closer and closer to the body, he realizes that this is so much more than that. The first responding officer immediately calls over the police radio for backup. He tells radio dispatchers that there is a young girl completely naked who appears to have been brutally murdered down by the river. Once backup arrives on the scene, police immediately close off the entire area and begin their initial investigation. Now, you guys, these types of crime scenes are super difficult for police to investigate. Because it's down by the river in a completely wide open space, it's so hard for crime scene investigators to find and collect evidence that is constantly being exposed to the elements. And by this point in the investigation, Police have no idea how long that body has been out there in the elements. And it's not like a crime scene inside a house or something where you can easily maybe close the door and basically lock down the entire area. An area like this is super difficult for investigators and crime scene technicians. So right away here, first responders know that they're up against the clock to find and collect valuable forensic evidence. But investigators and crime scene technicians were able to collect valuable evidence around the body. Police immediately noticed that there were several bloody rocks surrounding the victim's body, telling police they may have just found their murder weapon. Not too far from the victim's body, police found a pair of socks, neatly folded on a rock nearby. Other than the rocks, the victim was completely naked, and no other pieces of clothes were found near her body. After police collect the socks, they make their way back to the body. And now, by this point in the morning, the medical examiner has arrived on scene, so now they're able to turn the body over to get a better idea of how this girl died. Now, without getting into too much of the gory details here, once the medical examiner turned the girl's body over, her face was described as being, quote, almost gone. In addition to the blunt force trauma to her head and face, the victim also showed signs of defensive wounds on her hands, and there was a large puncture on the bottom of one of her feet. The defensive wounds on her hands and wrists are really important here that I want to mention, because it tells us that whoever this Jane Doe is, she fought. She fought for her life here. She fought to save her life against whoever this attacker was. And when I read about cases in which we see these obvious defensive wounds on our victims, it just really hits me. And it makes me think about the strength and the courage victims have, even up until the very last minute. So by looking at the victim and how badly her face was attacked, police were luckily able to identify two tattoos on the body. Tattoos are a great identifier for police, especially when we try to identify a Jane Doe, because police can talk to friends and family and find out from them who their victim is based on these tattoos. The victim in this case had two distinct tattoos. There was one tattoo on her shoulder and another one on her left breast. The tattoo on her left breast was super interesting to police because it read the name, quote, Chris, over a heart. Without looking any further, this tattoo tells police that they already have their very first suspect. On the scene, the medical examiner and the police believe that the victim was beaten to death by the granite rocks found around the body. So investigators collected several rocks with blood on them. Some rocks were the size of a softball, while others were over 50 pounds. So besides the rocks and the socks found near the body, investigators really couldn't find any other valuable forensic evidence. It appeared to first responders that this was going to be a really difficult case from the beginning, and that their first step was to give Jane Doe a name. The following morning, the medical examiner was able to confirm that the woman they found along the river was killed by blunt force trauma to the skull. The medical examiner found 16 separate blows to her face and to her neck. By the rigor mortis and other factors, they were also able to determine that their Jane Doe likely had died between 8 and 10 hours prior to when she was discovered by the rancher and his son. Now, rigor mortis is a really useful way for medical examiners to determine the time of death, because when we die, our bodies begin to stiffen. And the progression of rigor mortis serves as like a stopwatch in terms of figuring out how much time has passed since someone has died. Basically, the longer the time after death, the greater rigor mortis is likely to be present in the body. Once the medical examiner determined that Jane Doe likely died 8 to 10 hours before her discovery, he made the super, super smart decision to collect valuable forensic evidence from the body. Now remember, this murder occurred way back in 1995, when, in terms of forensic science, that is basically the dark ages here. So in 1995, we really didn't have anywhere near the amount of technology and the tests that we now have in 2020 or whenever you're listening to this episode. So this medical examiner was such a forward thinker and knew, hey, we might not be able to perform these tests today in 1995, but let me just collect evidence just in case, like hair samples, bodily fluids, fingernails, and let's just save them for when our abilities in forensic science are much better. So smart, you guys. So the next huge step for the medical examiner was to give Jane Doe a name. He knew she was someone's daughter. She was someone's friend. And someone was going to be looking for her. So the medical examiner ran her fingerprints in the National FBI database, but he got nothing. So police decide to submit her information to the National Missing Person Database. And again, they get nothing. Jane Doe has no ID. She has no wallet. She doesn't even have any clothes. The only thing that Jane Doe has were those two distinct tattoos. Police knew that someone out there was going to be able to recognize those two tattoos. So they had the great idea that one of their officers could actually sketch out one of the tattoos and broadcast it on the local news to try and find someone out there who could recognize them. That same exact night, after showing the tattoo on the local news, police got a phone call that they had been waiting for. On the other end of the phone was a young man who identified himself as Chris. He tells police, almost in a panic, that he saw the news and he thinks that this his girlfriend might be Jane Doe. Police immediately arrive at the motel Chris is staying at and start asking him questions. So us true crime addicts know that the boyfriend or the husband or whoever the significant other is always the first and prime suspect. And that's because our significant others are the closest people to us. And sadly, the other side of that is that oftentimes the people that are closest to us actually have the biggest motive when it comes to murder, whether that's rage or jealousy or something else. So if your wife goes missing, guys, don't be surprised if you're the first door that police go knocking on. So once police arrive at Chris's motel, he tells the detectives, yeah, that's my girlfriend. Her name is Tracy, and she usually goes by the nickname Baby C on the streets. When questioned about where was the last time he'd seen Tracy, he told them about how she left that night and went to go pick up some dinner at the local Circle K. He told police that it was so unlike her to not come home. Further into their conversation with police, Chris shared some very interesting facts about his girlfriend, Tracy. Chris told police during their interview that his girlfriend Tracy had a very weird phobia about socks. He told police that she had a big phobia about taking her socks off, even in front of him. Chris said that he would always make fun of her for folding her socks a certain way whenever she did take them off. Now, by this point, Chris is still the number one suspect. Even though police don't have any strong physical or forensic evidence against him, things just don't seem right. After talking to Chris, the police now have positively identified their Jane Doe. Once they head back to the police station, they immediately pull any records they can find on Tracy, which just so happens to include contact information for Tracy's father. One of the hardest jobs that I think homicide detectives have is to notify the family of murder victims. I can't even imagine how terrible and how awful it would be to have to tell someone that their son, their daughter, or whoever is dead. But on December 17th, police picked up the phone and dialed Tracy's father. Police broke the devastating news to Tracy's father and explained to him that his young teenage daughter was found brutally murdered along the Provo River. The phone line was silent. The man on the other end simply said, "That can't be my daughter. My daughter Tracy is sleeping in the room right next to me." The detective thought maybe this guy was mistaken, because they had already positively identified Tracy as Jane Doe. How could this possibly be a mistake? After a few moments of just total confusion, the man on the other end of the phone explained to police that Jane Doe that they were talking about might actually be his stepdaughter, Crystal. He told the detective that Crystal had a long history of using Tracy's name and identity and always gave out false information so that no one really knew who Crystal was. According to her stepfather, Crystal started working as a prostitute at a very young age and, quote, never had a chance. Jane Doe wasn't Tracy after all. Jane Doe was Crystal Beslanowicz. Crystal Beslanowicz was born on June 6, 1978. Her biological father died in a drowning accident when Crystal was only 4 years old, and she had a terrible relationship with her mother growing up. Crystal was constantly running away from home. She was in and out of youth homes, getting arrested, and just spending her time out on the streets. According to friends and family, Crystal actually felt safer on the streets than she did in her very own home. After talking to Crystal's stepfather, police were able to get her mother's contact information. When police had a chance to sit down and talk to Crystal's mom, she shared with the detectives that, yeah, Crystal did have a troubled childhood. She got into drugs at a super early age. She ran with a wild group of friends. And her mother shared with the police the heartbreaking thought that she knew that this day would come for her daughter, Crystal. By this point, Crystal's boyfriend, Chris, just keeps on looking better and better as their prime suspect in her murder. Remember, Chris already told police for himself that his girlfriend's name was Tracy, not Crystal. Police had suspected that he was deliberately lying about Crystal's true identity, and this just made Chris seem more guilty and guilty by the minute. If Chris was lying about Crystal's true identity, what else was Chris lying about? For the third time, police and Chris sit down for another interview. By this point, police fully go into the interview, expecting to get just that much closer to making an arrest. But that's not exactly what happens next. Chris tells police that Crystal was the breadwinner in their relationship. Chris really relied on Crystal. Chris had absolutely no money. He's broke. He doesn't have a job. He doesn't even have a car. How was Chris supposed to kill his girlfriend Crystal and get her body nearly 45 miles away from the motel that they shared? And why would Chris kill Crystal? She made all the money in the relationship. His life basically depended on her making money. What motive does he have to kill the only person that he relies on for almost everything? Well, it turns out Chris didn't have the motive. And frankly, he didn't have the means to kill Crystal that night. So as quickly as Chris rose to the top of the suspect list, he came crashing back down right to the bottom. Police now had to start back at square one to try and figure out who is Crystal's killer. If her boyfriend Chris didn't kill her, who did? Police knew that Crystal worked as a sex worker and was known on the streets as Baby Tracy. So police started talking to girls out on the streets, asking them if they knew anything about what had happened to Crystal or who she might have been with the night she was killed. Unfortunately, this is just a way too common thing where people out on the streets just don't give police much of anything. And they find themselves still at square one in the investigation of who killed Crystal. 3 days later, on December 19th, police get what they had been hoping for, a brand new lead in the case. A guy named Herb Fry met Crystal while driving his taxi throughout her neighborhood. Herb admitted to investigators that, yeah, he had some pretty deep feelings for Crystal and that he really cared about this girl. The guy even told police that he wanted to marry Crystal someday. With this new information, police really wanted to talk to Herb more about what he remembers about the last time he saw Crystal alive. Herb told police that he was actually with Crystal the day that she went missing. He said that the two of them were chatting outside her motel room and that he was trying to get her to go out with him, but she told him she couldn't because she had to work that night. The next thing Herb says is Crystal just left and that he had absolutely no idea what happened to her next. Well, to police, Herb Fry was starting to look pretty good for the murder. Unlike the boyfriend, Herb had means. He had a taxi car. He had motive. He was head over heels in love with Crystal. Herb Fry quickly moved to the top of the suspect list. Police think they may finally have their guy. Police started talking to some of Herb's friends, and what they found out was even more disturbing than what they had already thought. Herb wasn't just in love with Crystal. He was obsessed with her. Friends of Herb told police that he said, quote, "If I can't have her, no one can have her." After Crystal Beslanowicz was laid to rest by her friends and family, police had two main suspects in her brutal murder: the boyfriend Chris and the taxi driver Herb Fry. But police had absolutely zero forensic evidence linking either Chris or Herb to the murder at the river. Although they felt that Herb was better for it, they knew that they weren't going to be able to make an arrest and bring him to trial without any physical or forensic evidence. And unfortunately, guys, we see this happen a lot. Juries nowadays pretty much expect that the prosecution will present some sort of forensic evidence to pin their suspect. It's very rare for cases, especially homicide cases, to be decided solely on what is called circumstantial evidence, or basically evidence that relies on an inference to connect it to a conclusion of facts. Basically, because our suspects did this and our suspect didn't do that, he must have done it. And a case is even harder to prosecute when, in addition to no forensic evidence, there's also no additional direct evidence in the case. Like there's no witnesses, there's no one to say what happened. So at this point in the investigation, police just don't have enough to arrest either Chris or Herb in the murder of Crystal Beslanowicz. 11 long years would pass, and there's still no break in the murder of Crystal Beslanowicz. Back in 1995, when Crystal was murdered, it was pretty common for crime scene investigators to really only collect blood and fingerprints from crime scenes. Nowadays, we literally collect everything. We're out there collecting hair, we're collecting bodily fluids, fibers, literally anything and everything we can get our hands on in hopes that it will lead us to our suspect. And that's what makes forensic science and forensic evidence so amazing. The evidence just doesn't lie. Forensic evidence is the truth. So if you remember the medical examiner in Crystal's case, he knew that someday our technology and our knowledge about forensic science would improve. He knew that they weren't able to test much back in 1995, but he knew that this would change. And boy, was he right. By 2008, forensic scientists were able to swab the rocks found around Crystal's body down by the river. They swabbed 4 of the 6 rocks found at the crime scene. They were able to confirm that the blood-stained rocks had a female DNA profile matching Crystal. But they were also able to find skin cells from the unstained portion of the rocks. Forensic scientists believe that the skin cells belonged to their killer. The DNA found on the unstained portion of the rock was determined to be a male DNA profile. But the sample was so small that forensic scientists weren't able to get a full DNA profile. So police took this partial sample of the male DNA profile and compared it to their two main suspects, Crystal's boyfriend Chris and the taxi driver Herb Fry. Crystal's former boyfriend Chris immediately provides police his DNA, and the test comes back proving that his DNA did not match the partial sample found on the rock. So years later, Chris was officially eliminated as a suspect in Crystal's murder. The next person the police wanted to compare the partial profile to was Herb Fry, the taxi driver who was completely obsessed with Crystal back in 1995. Unlike Chris, police didn't want to approach Herb about providing a DNA sample. So they decided to set up a surveillance to get a better idea about his movements and his habits. One afternoon, police followed Herb to work, waited for him to take a break to smoke a cigarette, and as soon as Herb finished smoking his cigarette, he did like any other smoker does, and he just threw the cigarette on the sidewalk. Once Herb returned back inside at work, police picked up the discarded cigarette and immediately tested it against the partial DNA profile from the rocks. The test, you guys? Well, It came back negative. Herb Fry did not kill Crystal Beslanowicz. Just like in the year 1995, police again were asking the question, who killed Crystal? Several more years would pass without any answers as to who brutally murdered Crystal Beslanowicz down by the river. By the year 2013, there was a new DNA extraction tool known as the MVAC system. The MVAC is basically a sterile, small, wet vacuum. The system sprays a collection solution onto a surface while at the same time it vacuums the surface. It creates like a mini hurricane that loosens up the DNA material that is transferred into a collection bottle where the DNA material can be concentrated into a filter. Okay, hopefully that's not too sciencey, but basically, you guys, the MVAC is pretty much the world's greatest vacuum and one of the best tools to hit the forensic science world. Forget Dyson. The MVAC is truly the world's greatest vacuum. So in 2013, forensic scientists decided to use the MVAC on the granite rocks found at the murder scene. Now here's the point where you might be thinking, how in the world can you test the same rock for DNA after 18 years? Well, we do this all the time. If the forensic evidence is properly extracted and stored, we're totally able to test for DNA and other forensic evidence much longer than 18 years. And another reason why we're all voting MVAC for the world's greatest vacuum is because the system can test on the toughest, most uneven surfaces. And if you've ever touched or picked up a piece of granite rock before, you know that the surface of these rocks are super uneven and they've got this porous-like feel to them. But the MVAC is actually able to really get down into the cracks, into the crevices of the granite rock, and is finally able to pull a complete male DNA profile. 18 years after the savage murder of Crystal Beslanowicz, police take the full DNA profile obtained using the MVAC system and they enter it into the FBI's CODIS system. If you haven't heard of CODIS before, it's our nation's national DNA database and is maintained by the FBI. So in most states, I know California does, if you commit certain crimes like felonies or some domestic violence charges, you're often required to submit your DNA into the FBI's CODIS database. So now once CODIS has your DNA profile, if you commit a crime in the future, well, sorry, you can now have your DNA be matched in our database. It's pretty cool. So once investigators run the profile through CODIS, it comes back with an exact DNA match. Joseph Michael Simpson. Nearly 18 years after the brutal murder of Crystal Beslanowicz, police used the MVAC system to retrieve a full DNA profile from the granite rocks collected at the crime scene. Once the DNA profile was run through the FBI's national database, police get the hit they've been waiting almost two decades for. The DNA found on the granite rock belonged to the killer, Joseph Michael Simpson. Joseph Simpson is no stranger to the criminal justice system. In 1987, Simpson was actually convicted of homicide after he stabbed a man 13 times after becoming jealous that the man talked to a girl that he had his eyes on. When police learn about Simpson's 1987 murder conviction, they saw a lot of similarities between the case and the case of Crystal Beslanowicz. They saw the rage. the overkill, the anger, the brutality. After the 1987 murder conviction, Simpson was released on parole in 1995 and right away started working for an airport hotel shuttle company. So Simpson would basically take people from the airport to the hotel and vice versa. Police right away found out that the route between the airport and the hotel had Simpson constantly going through Park City and the Provo area day in and day out. Simpson would drive the same exact road where Crystal's body was found every single day. In 2003, while still on parole, Simpson was allowed to leave the state of Utah and move in with family down in Florida. In August 2013, police were able to track Simpson down at his mother's home in Florida. They knew they needed Simpson's DNA to make an arrest for the murder of Crystal all those years back. Police needed to be 100% sure they had the right suspect. There was absolutely no room for error. Police started to watch every move made by Simpson. They watched him at home. They watched him go into work. And finally, on August 25th, police saw Simpson smoke a cigarette and casually discard it on the sidewalk. And that's when they moved in. The police immediately took the discarded cigarette back to the crime lab to test it against the DNA profile obtained from the granite rocks. Now, all they could do is wait. 10 days later, they had a perfect DNA match. A match made in DNA heaven. 17 years, 9 months, and 2 days after the brutal and savage murder of Crystal Beslanowicz, police arrest Joseph Michael Simpson. Prosecutors make the case that shortly after 8 o'clock p.m. on December 14th, 1995, Crystal told her boyfriend Chris that she was going to grab some food at the local Circle K, but she was actually going to meet up with Simpson. Prosecutors believe that Simpson used money and drugs in order to get Crystal to go out with him that night. Simpson took her to that deserted river road. He initiates an unwanted sexual encounter with her, and this is when Crystal wants out. Crystal got out of Simpson's car and started to make a run for it. As Crystal is deciding to run away from Simpson, she hits a wire and punctures the bottom of one of her feet. Simpson eventually catches up to Crystal, where he picks up a granite rock and begins repeatedly hitting her over the head until she eventually loses her life. No one was around. No one heard a sound. Crystal was simply left there to die. The forensic evidence in this case was too overwhelming. The blood-stained portions of the granite rocks matched Crystal, and the male DNA profile discovered by the MVAC was a perfect match to Simpson. Simpson was 110% the man who held and picked up those granite rocks to strike Crystal over the head. The forensic science tells the complete story. On September 29th, 2016, all these years after the murder, a jury found Simpson guilty of the murder of Crystal Beslanowicz. Until the DNA connection was made using the MVAC technology, Simpson was never linked or even suspected in her murder. It's quite likely, in my opinion, that without the MVAC system in this case, Simpson would still be a free man today. And Crystal's family would still be without justice in her murder. The MVAC system technology provides us assurance in knowing that touch DNA and touch evidence is now easier than ever to find. No matter the surface, no matter how old the evidence is, the MVAC has the power and the technology to identify even the smallest traces of DNA. The MVAC just became the world's greatest vacuum. Forensic Tales is a Rockefeller Audio production. If you want to read more about the murder of Crystal Beslanovic or about the MVAC system that was used to solve the case, please visit my website, ForensicTales.com. Before you hit stop on whatever device you're using to listen to Forensic Tales, please take 60 seconds and leave us a rating with a review. Simply leaving a rating helps promote the show and get it out there to other true crime addicts just like you and I. As always, I greatly appreciate your support of my show and can't wait until our next episode next Monday. Until then, remember, not all stories have happy endings.